would like to begin by talking about how I came to write the book Dark Emu. I had written an essay for a Canberra publishing company, which became a book. And on the first page of my draft, I said that Aboriginal people had been conducting agriculture in Australia. After I'd written a book called Convincing Ground about the contact wars in Australia, it became very apparent to me that Aboriginal people were doing a lot more than hunting and gathering. And so I included that in the draft of this book, and I was told by a group of academics that it was impossible to include agriculture and Aborigine in the same sentence. I left that meeting and I bought as many second-hand copies of the Explorer's Diaries as I could find. And on page 89 of Sir Thomas Mitchell's Journeys Through Tropical Australia, I read these lines, which I can virtually recite from memory. Mitchell said that they were, he and his fellow explorers were travelling through the Bolon country on the New South Wales-Queensland border, and they rode through 9 miles of stooped grain. I'd been taught history in primary school and secondary school. I became a school teacher and I taught English and history to students, and I'd never heard or seen that text before. I was ashamed to be an Aboriginal man and not to know it. I was full of hurt and shame and indignation that that story had been withheld from me as an Australian. Not just as an Aboriginal person, but as an Australian. So I then pledged myself to learn as much about this as I could. I came across a diary by Lieutenant Gray, who wasn't much of an explorer, but he was very wealthy. So the wealthy can do whatever they like, and he decided to become an explorer. He lost all his horses in an accident with whale boats on the shores of Broome, and that's a story in itself. Take a couple of hours and probably a slab of beer to tell it properly. But he then had to walk back to Perth because he'd lost everything. And he and his fellows began that walk, and they came across a field that had been cultivated so deeply they couldn't walk across it. He thought that was unusual. It's not what he'd come to Australia to expect, because no one had mentioned it before. And no one had warned him that he might expect this. He was walking through country that no European had walked through before, but even so, he was shocked. The next day, he came across another field exactly the same, perhaps a little wider, and he had to walk around it. He couldn't walk across it. It was so deeply cultivated. And the next day, he came to another one. There were log houses on the boundaries of these fields. There were wells dug periodically in order to irrigate the crop, and there were paths all through it. And some of his fellows said they looked like the beaten paths of English villages. I was amazed by this reference in our history, our available history, and amazed that I'd never been taught it by any of my school teachers, none of whom were mass murderers or deliberately trying to hurt children, except on occasions. But this is part of Australian history and it wasn't being taught to us. I read Charles Sturt's journal. Sturt was having terrible times in his attempt to find the inland sea, and he was climbing these vertical sand dunes, one after another, and he and his fellows were virtually dying. They had run out of water completely. If they didn't find water soon, they were going to die within 24 hours. They got on one last sand dune, stood at the top, looked down, and they were hailed by 400 Aboriginal people. He was shocked that there should be so many Aboriginal people in a land in which he was dying. How were these people surviving? What he found out was, when he got to the bottom of that hill, that those people brought coolamons of water from their own well and held it out to him and his men, and then turned to the horses, an animal they'd never seen before, and allowed the horses to drink, even with the horses' whiskers touching their fingers. Sturt commented in his journal about the bravery of those people, but then he had to comment on their generosity because they fed him and his men roast duck and cake. Sturt referred to those cakes as the lightest and sweetest he'd ever eaten. And you might expect people starving to death to exaggerate a little, but he was backed up by Sir Thomas Mitchell, who'd eaten the same sort of cakes several times, and he used exactly the same phrase, the sweetest and lightest. The people had been harvesting a crop they'd sown in the ephemeral riverbed of the Warburton River. They'd converted it into flour, and they'd been living a bounteous life there with the wildfowl that was still on the ponds in the drying stream, and converting this grass into flour so that they could live well in the what is now called Sturt's Stony Desert, the dead heart of Australia. No Europeans live there today. No crops are grown there because it's impossible for Aboriginal people to grow that grain with buffalo and camels and cattle wandering across it. It was an incredible scheme, an incredible devotion of labour, and an incredible bit of science and agriculture, and yet this country knows nothing about it. The thing that really shocks me is that 220 years of academic research in this country, and no one can say what that grass was that those people were growing. Here is a very, very important source of flour for Australia. Grows on sand, needs only one watering, needs no fertiliser, needs no pesticide, produces the lightest and sweetest cakes in the world. We have 230 television shows about cooking in this country. No one has ever referred to it. You know, this is an absence of scholarship. And I say to Aboriginal kids all the time, you know, these I go to schools and universities, and I say, if you want to live an interesting but penniless life, find out what that grass was, because it's not impossible to find it out. I think I know what it is, but I'm not going to tell you just yet. But I'd like my own people to find that out, to find out what their great-great-grandfathers and great-great-grandmothers did. Sir Thomas Mitchell, in his journals, as I said before, rode through 9 miles of stooped grain, but he also rode through villages where every house was different and 1,000 people lived there. He remarked on the beauty of those houses, the grace of their design, and the bounty of the food that was growing on their roofs and walls. The next day, after describing that first village that surprised him so much, because he'd also come to Australia, believing that Aboriginal people were hunters and gatherers and merely wandering around the face of the globe fairly helplessly. The next day he found another village, another 1,000 people. The next day, another village, another 1,000 people. These people were close to the town of what is now Brewarrina, near the great fish traps. And those people were growing grain so that when the fishermen came to make use of the fish traps, they could all be fed, like a great harvest festival. one of the great festivals that the world has known. Some people say that the Bramarana stone fish traps are the oldest human constructions on earth. In the whole of Australian literature, there is one book written about those fish traps, and it's 60 pages long. 220 years of academic scholarship in this country, and we've got this tiny book that was written in 1972. It's shocking to think that we could have the oldest human construction on earth and not one tourist bus goes there. What's going on? Isaac Beatty came to Melbourne to take up farming around the Melbourne district. He'd come out on a boat and he'd been told that there were virtually no Aboriginal people around, and anyway, they didn't use the land, which he found hard to understand because the hillsides of Melbourne had been terraced in the production of yam daisy. He was a farmer from England. He knew what water conservation was all about. He knew what soil conservation was all about, and he knew what intensive agriculture looked like. He recognised these terraces for what they were, and yet virtually no one else in the government of Victoria, as it became to be known, mentions these things. Why? There was a woman around about 32,000 years ago near Cuddy Springs, and she must have harvested some grain and looked at it, and she must have gone to bed that night, dreamt about it, thought about it, got up the next morning and said, "I'm going to grind these between two stones." When she did that, she discovered she had flour, and the genius of that woman allowed her to combine the flour with water and apply it to heat to it, and she made bread. And I read about that in the Melbourne Age 3 years ago, and I thought, you know, being a complete idiot, I thought, gee, that's interesting. I thought, I wonder who else made bread before that. So being a modern man, I Googled it, and I found that the Google and Wikipedia acknowledged the Egyptians as being the first people on earth to make bread 17,000 years ago, 15,000 years after one of our women, one of your women, your Australians, this is your country, one of your women. Why don't we learn this in school? Why do we go overseas and brag about bloody Vegemite? Why do we talk about the Hills Hoist and the Stump Jump Plough as being the great Australian inventions? And here we had a woman whose brain allowed her to invent bread. We never talk about it. I want Australians to go overseas, and when they've worked out that you don't come from Austria, and they start asking you, "Have you got kangaroos in the street?" You go, "Well, we do in where we live. We've got kangaroos in the street, so we have to say yes, we have." But that's not our fault. But I'd like people to say, "Look, I come from the country that invented bread," and watch the French get disturbed then. But it's a triumph of intelligence, ingenuity, science, agriculture, all of those things. And it's probably older than 32,000 years, because in 220 years, how many grinding stones have been analysed with that purpose in mind? One. So the chances of actually finding the oldest grinding stone in Australia at the first try is, you know, like backing Richmond to win the grand final, you know. It's long odds, especially after last Saturday night. So the professors that told me that I couldn't mention agriculture and Aborigine in the same sentence had set me a challenge. And as I turned the pages of these history books, I'll tell you, I had tears in my eyes because I was finding tools, Aboriginal tools, to fight this argument. There's nothing wrong with being a hunter and gatherer. And a lot of the things of food collection in this country are similar to hunting and gathering. But the truth is, we were not hunters and gatherers, mere hunters and gatherers. Why were we described as hunters and gatherers with no permanent abode, Sturt seeing his villages all over the place, describing the harmony, the beauty, the care of the children in those villages, the beautiful sounds at night as women ground the grain into flour. He said, "The apart from the dogs barking, the children singing, and the soft voices of the women as they were making the bread, you could hear the grinding dishes going from every house." He spends a page and a half talking about the beauty of those villages. This is a civilization we know and care so little about in this country. So I was thrilled to find these references, thrilled to be able to debunk this idea of Australian Aboriginal people being hapless wanderers. Unfortunately, I believe that insistence on our country in perpetrating this lie is to justify possession of the land. If you can argue back to your own people in England, back to your own government in Australia, that Aboriginal people aren't doing anything with the land, they're not sophisticated enough to use it, they don't deserve it. And nothing is further from the truth. How was all of this managed? How could you grow crops that would extend beyond three language boundaries? How was it possible? Surely someone would take the sword, invent the sword, and then take it to his neighbours so that he could have all the grain, just as had been done on every other corner of the world, every other continent, every other civilization that lasted a magical 2,000 years. That's where we send our archaeologists, to Egypt, to look at pyramids that are 2,000 years old, and they need another review, like Macbeth, Shakespeare's Macbeth needs another book of critical review. And that's what we do. There's all this work to be done here, this reverential work, and we're not doing it. It's a mighty task for you young people here. You're all young people. You're all younger than me, so you can all get into under that label. But for you people at school, you young people at school, you challenge your teachers. They teach you some rubbish about Australian history, and you say, "Hang on, I don't think that's right." And if you're Aboriginal, you'll be up to the principal straight away. I've spent a fair bit of my life in principal's offices arguing on behalf of kids who have said that Captain Cook did not discover Australia. 1991, a kid was suspended in Geelong for saying that Captain Cook did not discover Australia. All right, he did swear once. But he was right, that kid, and he was suspended. And, you'd think, all you've got to do is talk to the principal, man to man, talk a bit about footy, have a cup of tea, and it'll all be sweet. No, a month That kid was out of school for a month. And he was so angry. You know, he never really settled in school again, that kid. But I love him to pieces. He's a great man. We're teaching our young people. I'm living on Ewan land. That's my part of my family's land at the moment down on the south coast of New South Wales. And we've got a food company called Gurungi Munji. I'd be surprised if some people here didn't help us in the Possible campaign last Christmas to raise money. And we've employed a young woman to work on growing yam daisy for us. And she's doing a fabulous job. And this has allowed us to put some intensive work into bringing back these plants, which were domesticated plants of Aboriginal people. One of the testaments to civilization in the world that scientists talk about is domesticating plants. They also talk about building houses, sewing clothes. I was with Richard Franklin down in Melbourne the other night, and Tiriki Onus, and they've been doing this possum skin cloak campaign, which was started by half a dozen Aboriginal women. Vicky Cousins was one of them, a Gunishmara woman. And this revival of the possum skin cloak tradition is so important, because one day someone is going to be asked in court, "I'm glad the Jajarung have got their land. I'm glad the Gunai have got their land, and that the Gunditjmara got their land, but there are another 30 Aboriginal groups in Victoria who haven't got any land." And so one day someone's going to walk into a court of law where a judge is about to say, "Your history has been washed away by the tide of history. You don't have a history in this country. You cannot say you are Yorta Yorta. The Yorta Yorta still fight in this battle." And one day I hope that one of them will walk into court in a possum skin cloak where the sewing is so fine you can hardly see it, where the design of that whole country is drawn on the inside of that cloak. And I hope that woman will have a handful of grains and a bag full of tubers and say, "I'm Yorta Yorta, give us the land."